If you follow the world of comics and graphic art, chances are the name Linda Barry will ring a bell. She's an artist whose work is widely credited with deepening the voice of fiction in comics and paving the way for graphic novels. Barry's syndicated strip, Ernie Pook's Comique, ran for years in alternative publications. She's just published a new book called What It Is. It's part memoir, part activity book, and, of course, part comic. It celebrates the artist in all of us and reveals some of Barry's techniques for unlocking creativity. What It Is recently won the Eisner Award for Best Reality-Based Work. Barry told Steve Paulson how the book came about.
I didn't want to write a book about writing that was writing. You know, writing about writing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's more for people who have always wanted to write but are just too confused about where to even begin.
Or they think, what am I going to write about?
Or it's too late for me. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, you probably had this experience when you were maybe about 9. You'll hear on the radio, somebody will say, if you want to be a gymnast, you have to start by age 4.
Right.
So you're 9 and you go, you're already washed up. You know what I mean? You get this feeling that it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling is that human beings, I don't consider the arts or what we call the arts or kids call play, I don't consider it to be decoration. I think it has an absolute biological function. I mean, an absolute, very important biological function. And I also think that we all have the capacity for it, even though we may not recognize it. And the way I explain it pretty simply to people is, if you've ever had that experience of smelling a smell, and then suddenly there you are in Aunt Carol's kitchen, and she's making that green jello cottage cheese salad that you know you're going to have to try to eat later on. If you can have that flooding of memory, people have it all day long, and if you can freeze frame that and write from there. And the secret to writing, to me, is to write for very short periods of time, like 8 minutes. When I teach in my class, our writing period is 8 minutes.
Really? I would think that you'd just be starting to get warmed up after
Well,
eight
you
minutes.
Get warmed up beforehand. So an example that I give people is I ask them to think about early days and think about a car from early days. So if you picture a car in your head, so people picture a car. And then I'll say, as you picture it, are you inside of the car or outside of the car? People know, okay, I'm inside of the car. Is it day or night? They know. What season does it seem to be? They can answer that. And then I try to orient them in space. Where is the car parked? What's in front of you? What's to your left? What's to your right? Behind you? Above you and below? So that you're ready to go, no matter what age you are. And that's the thing I like the most, is when I have a group of people who are all different ages, that when we start to write from that place, those memories, and only write for 8 minutes. And what I usually do is I tell people when they have 3 more minutes and then about 1 more minute. And if you think about when you're talking on the phone to somebody and suddenly you realize you only have 3 more minutes, you know how to edit that story down.
It's like doing a radio interview. You know when the clock is winding down.
That's right. And we all have that. We all have that sense of time. We all have that sense of being able to tell a story. But somehow, when we pick up a pen, or worse, with a computer, which has a delete button, that poor delete button has erased so many good stories, then we freeze. So what I try to do is get people to write, but not let them know that they're writing. I mean, they are using a pen, and they're using paper, but it's more working from that experience, especially if it's an unexpected memory. People really want to talk about it.
So why do you call your workshop Writing the Unthinkable?
Call it Writing the Unthinkable because it is about that spontaneous associative memory rather than thinking. Like I always say to my students, you know that statue, the thinker, that guy who's like, he has his fist to his forehead and his face, it looks very tight. That to me looks like a guy who's never going to get an idea in his life. I mean, that's why I'm washed up. Why?
Well, that's so interesting. So you're saying that you see thinking as kind of almost, I don't want to say the opposite of writing or the creative process, but it's something quite different.
I think thinking is really important. I think it's probably the most recent part of our brain. And it's also the part that I always think, well, it thinks it's driving in a way. Like I always thought for a while, if I had an unconscious, I'd know about it. You know what I mean? Like when I first heard about it, the unconscious, I thought if I had one, I'd know about it. And then I pictured it as being this little tiny pea-sized thing in the back of my head. But now I feel like I'm a pea-sized thing in it, you know? So my feeling is that the thinking part of us isn't all there is, but unfortunately, as we get older and older and older, we tend to just keep ourselves in that little space. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of times people won't write something or make a drawing, because what are they going to do with it afterwards? Adults care about that.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, like my little brother used to do this thing where he'd take a piece of paper, he'd fold it in half, And then with a little pencil, he'd draw like an entire stick army, like the whole army, right? And then on the other side of the fold, he'd draw an entire other army. Mm-hmm. And then he'd put the drawing in front of him, and then he'd get a bowl of cereal, and he'd start to eat the cereal real slow and go into that cereal trance. You know that cereal trance? You know what I'm talking about? Where everything, right. I mean, we will eat cereal and then read, we'll read the ingredients on the side like it's a poem. You know, like dextrose. I'm going to name my first baby dextrose. You know what I mean? It's like this beautiful, it's a state of mind. And then when he, after his cereal trance, he'd move his bowl of cereal over, he'd take a red crayon and start the war. And he'd start bombing and he'd do sound effects. That's the other thing. When kids draw, they do sound effects. Save yourself, serpentine, tell my wife I love her. You know, I'd be sitting there watching him. And then when he was done, here was this paper that was just covered with marks. It was really quite beautiful. And what would he do with that paper? Nothing.
Right.
Throw it away.
Right. Yeah.
If an adult spent 10 minutes doing that, then they'd be in a dilemma. What do I do with this?
Right. Do I try to frame it? Is it good enough, or do I toss it in the wastebasket?
Does it mean I'm really good? Am I good? Or does it mean I've been messing around my whole life and it's finally caught up with me? I mean, so that dilemma of what to do with the thing afterwards, I mean, if you knew a kid that couldn't draw unless they knew what it was for, or what's our budget? What's our budget for this drawing? Or, you know, I mean, if you worry about them.
Yeah. So you teach writing workshops, mm-hmm. this thing that you call writing the unthinkable. What do you do? I mean, what's some of your advice?
Well, when we write, I have a really, it's actually one of my friends who's been to a number of my workshops calls it, it's like a donut recipe. It's a real recipe. What I do is, it's pretty simple. I ask people to number from 1 to 10. Then I usually have a... Actually, I'm just going to take a second and get it out of here. Out of my, I usually have a bag that is full of index cards that have words on them. So I don't even know what word. So but here, in this case, I have a deck of cards. And each of them has a word written on it. So go ahead and
pick a card. Okay, here we go. I've picked a card.
What's your word?
Chicken.
Chicken. All right. So you'd have your page number from 1 to 10. Then I'd give you the word chicken, and your first response would be, chicken? This is a really bad word. But as people, I just sit there, and they have 3 minutes to write down the first 10 images that come to them from that word chicken. And then from there, we pick one that's vivid, and then we do this thing where we orient ourselves in space. So chicken, see, I'm thinking chicken. I'm thinking my grandma, who's from the Philippines, who when she couldn't stand to cook at a table because she's used to squatting on the floor. So she'd lay newspapers out. Then she'd put a big old chopping block, and then she'd be chopping her chicken. But she also liked to listen to Elvis Presley. And my uncle, who was from the Philippines, would be singing along, "You saw me crying in the chapel." And, you know, so I can, like, really build that whole room. Mm-hmm. And so what we do in the class is I'd orient people in space and time. Where are you? About how old are you? What time of day is it? People tend to know. We actually draw a little map. And then from there, I ask them to write first person present tense. I am in the kitchen watching my grandma. Oh, she also, my grandma, who planted rice when she was growing up. And, you know, everybody in the Philippines started smoking when they were like 5. And so they learned to smoke with the cigarette with a lighted end in their mouth so it wouldn't get wet. Hmm. So she could do that. And we all thought she was like magical, you know. So she'd be doing that. And so even as I had that word chicken, this whole story kind of comes. It doesn't come in one sentence at a time. It comes as a full-on image. Hmm. You know what I mean?
So what you're doing then in your writing workshops, and it sounds like the way you write yourself, is you're conjuring up memories.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your path into the imagination.
Yeah, it's conjuring up memories. But once you understand what an image feels like when it's memory, once you know what that feels like, it is so easy to put that to fiction. Because what you start to realize is that fiction works exactly the same way. I wrote my first novel. It's a novelini. It's inky, binky, tiny. But I wrote it in 10 days using this same method. And then I thought, well, I better not do this too often or I'll have novels all over the house, you know. But my next one took me 10 years. And it took me 10 years because I thought I had to think it out and I thought I had to use a computer. And I thought I had to know what it was going to be about beforehand. I mean, it was all in that thinking, all in that little part of the brain that is very forceful but not very creative. And I finally gave up. I found myself walking around my studio after 10 years of trying to write this book saying this, okay, if it was me doing it, how would I do it? Hmm. Who else was it? Well, that's a good question. Who else was it? Okay, if I was doing it, who would it be? And I happened to babysit. I really like being around kids a lot. And I happened to babysit this kid who couldn't write yet but liked to tell stories. So I said, you want to tell me a story? And I'll write it down. And he goes, okay. So he says, once. So I wrote once. He goes, upon. So I wrote upon. And I said, Benny, you can tell it faster. I can write really fast. And he said, no. He wanted to see each word. And when it was written, he'd tell me the next word. By doing that, he had a story that had beginning, middle, end, foreshadowing, story arc, had everything in it. And I thought, if this guy could do it, I bet I can do it too. So that's what I tried to do, was slow the process down, not have any idea where it was going, start with a word or an image. And the book that I'd been trying to write for 10 years, I ended up writing in 9 months using that. And I also wrote it with a paintbrush. Sounds like the slowest possible way to write a book, but without a delete key. So much more is possible. And also, I'm convinced that writing by hand, using our hands, creates a completely different story than using a computer.
But let me follow up on that. I mean, this, because it raises a really interesting question. Yes, if you really want to write, it's great to sort of, I don't know, somehow put that judgmental self aside. You know, just don't worry about that, what other people are going to say about it, and just write. I mean, just call up your memories or whatever. But there does come a point, doesn't there, where you want to do something good.
Well, let's look at playing. If we have a kid who has, for instance, I saw this kid eating breakfast with his mom, and he was about 7, and she's on a cell phone. She's not paying attention to him at all. He's picking up this piece of bacon. He's about to eat it, but then all of a sudden, he starts to wiggle it, and he looks at it, and it's like he says to it, I'm going to eat you. And the bacon says, you know, he's wiggling the bacon. No, no, no. Yes, I'm going to eat you. And here's this, you know, I mean, we could go into the whole psychological. What did happen was, as he was having this interchange, which I was enjoying, his mother stopped her conversation and looked at him and said, what are you doing? And he was really embarrassed and had no idea. So she was basically saying, you know, unless you're doing something and you're good at it and it's for something, don't play with your food, in other words. But my feeling is, if we keep thinking that we should do this stuff so that we'd be good at it, that's a whole other thing. That's a whole other thing.
Is this something that only published writers should worry about? I mean, you obviously must think about, is it good or not, before you send a book to press.
You know, I when the book's done, I may, but I actually don't. And that's what I learned from Marilyn Frasca.
Your old teacher.
My old teacher. That's the thing I learned from her, which was that making this stuff has a function that is different than whether it's good or useful to someone. If it's good or useful to someone, that is cool. That's excellent, right? Just like the stories I hear from kids. They're very useful to me. But this idea of, is it good or not, that's what happens to our work. That's what happens. It only becomes those two questions. Is this good or is this bad? And there's nothing in between. And that's where I feel like that's where everything starts to become a desert, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's why we lean so hard on when watching TV, you know what I mean? And really, I always think it's like trying to get all our nutrition from gummy bears. They are the color of vegetables, but you have to eat a whole bunch of them and you're still going to not get the nutrition you need. And one of my concerns is that the arts, particularly playing music or drawing, all those things are being really, they're eliminated from the schools. They're really being taken away from our culture. And there's more and more of this feeling that unless you're good at it, you shouldn't do it. And I say, if this has a biological function, and if it has something to do with our mental health, that's the saddest thing in the world, that we would be talked out of doing the very thing. And there's some science behind it. You know, there's science behind neural connections and the health of our brain. And also, you know what's really interesting? People who have given up on the arts, you hand them a toddler, if they like babies, they'll sing. They'll dance for them. Yeah. They'll tell them a story. They'll sit down and draw with them. So all the arts, when we communicate with babies, we use all the arts.
Linda Barry is a celebrated cartoonist and novelist, best known for the long-running syndicated strip Ernie Pook's Comique. Her latest book is called What It Is.